And my duties were quite different. The intelligence officer, the brigade, had an observation post, and there were certain duties there. Also, there were occasional deserters came in, prisoners were taken, and we carried out our first interrogation of these chaps before they were passed down. We also had various other duties. There was nothing very exciting happened whilst I was there. We had a very fine, a very happy little mess. Brigadier, his staff captain, brigade major, his ADC, the MO, the padre, and myself. And we had quite a fairly happy time. Nothing very much happened until the big offensive. We had the Vardar was on our right. On our left, there was a Greek division, and on their left was a Serbian division. And the Serbs were undoubtedly the finest fighters in the whole of the Middle East, probably some of the finest fighters in the whole of the Allied armies. Wonderful, hard men, brave, who could climb mountains and get across country, over any territory, nearly as fast as the blessed cars can travel on the M1 today. Well, we chased the Bulgarians right back, right across Macedonia, till we got to the Kresna Pass. Now the Kresna is about 35 kilometers long, and the Bulgarian armies all had converged on this one pass. It was only about 40 to 50 feet, yards wide, a rushing river, some 20 yards wide, a narrow Decauville railway line, and the road. Then on each side of this river, one side and the road on the other side, on each side were very steep, very high cliffs, mountain, crags, rocks, call them what you like. The Bulgarian armies all converged onto this one pass. They entered the pass as an organized fighting army. But by the time the RFC in those days, the RFC, who had half a dozen bombers, finished with them, just going backwards and forwards, loading up bombs, coming along, dropping them, going back and getting more bombs, dropping them, with these cliffs on each side, the concussion of the exploding bombs must have been terrible. For when we came through chasing after the Bulgarians, there was the proof all along. Lorries and guns overturned onto the railway line, into the river, on the road, bodies of men, horses and everything up, smashed up against the rocks. Anyhow, the Bulgarian armies went in there as an organized army, fighting force, and came out the other end as a rabble. As they came through the other end, they just threw away their arms and they went off home. And that was the end of the Bulgarian war. And the armistice was signed, actually, I think it was on the 30th was it, of September, something like that. From there we were going on to meet the Turks, so we had to switch round. But by the time we had gone very far, a week or so, the Turks themselves surrendered. And then we had to come all the way back, hundreds of miles, back to Salonika, where I was taken away from the division and sent... No, I wasn't taken away from the division then. I went with one of the brigades to Chanak, the Dardanelles. And we had quite a lengthy period there, most interesting. Of course, war over, as far as we were concerned. A lot of riding, swimming, and quite a lot of interesting things to do and see, especially going through and over the very old forts that the Turks had in the Dardanelles. There are about 8 or 10 of these forts on each side of the straits. Very old, but most extraordinarily efficient. There was no stonework at all, just earthworks with slits for the big guns to fire through or along. And we were surprised at the guns they had. The shells were absolutely antediluvian in appearance, but the size of the guns made one gasp. An American general that I had the honor to take round one day to show him some of these forts, looked at one of the dates, and he said, 1897, and they had 13.5-inch guns. And do you know that we in America in 1897 had just one 9-inch gun, which was the pride of our army and the greatest military secret weapon, as we thought. And here these people all the time had 13.5 guns. We stayed in the Dardanelles quite a time and then went up to Constantinople. And the division headquarters went on to the Asiatic side at a place called Moda, not far from Kadikiri and Scutari. Scutari, of course, being the place where Florence Nightingale had her famous hospital. And we were at Moda for quite a time, really having a army of occupation, comfortable time. We requisitioned 2 big hotels, which became both our office headquarters and our living quarters. We organized a very fine mess, and we were there for quite a time. Whilst there, I was able to have one short leave, and I went to Smyrna, where mother and father and I had returned, and spent 10 days with them in Smyrna, and back again to Istanbul. Now, I think that's where I should leave it. No, I'll go on just that little bit further. Another few months, and I was given one or two odd jobs to do, one of which was to go back to the Dardanelles, where I picked up an Indian groom and a batman and 4 horses, one each for us and one as a pack horse. And I was given £200 in gold and a map with certain districts and roads, which were actually non-existent, marked out. And Army headquarters wanted a report on this particular district inland. So this batman, groom, and myself, four horses, and we had 3 weeks of finding our own way from place to place to place to place, all around the back, the interior of the Dardanelles. And I had to report on the state of the roads, bridges, the terrain, whether it was hilly, marshy, healthy, malarial, and so on. The attitude of the natives, whether they were friendly or not, and so on. This was quite an experience. There was I was 21, and I had this job, which I think was quite a big job for a youngster of that age, of that time. And we went round these villages. I was making reports and taking photographs of certain rivers and bridges and so on. And every night we'd stop at a village where we were all very well received. And one mustn't forget that the people in these villages had never seen a British officer, or probably a British at all. There were no hotels, no nothing. But every village had a little guest room. Empty, no furniture, just a hole in the wall, one end for fire. And you are welcome to put your bed down there and sleep there. It is always kept clean. Mud floor, and I would always send for the headman of the village, and of course he'd come along accompanied by two or three other chaps, and then there'd be an argument as to food, who was going to supply the food. We were prepared to pay for it, but these people wouldn't hear of such a thing. We were guests. And the headman would say, well, my wife will kill a chicken or somebody else. The head, schoolmaster would probably insist that he was the only man in the village who could read and write. He was the educated man, and it was up to him to entertain the honored guests. His wife would supply the food. And somebody else will say, I'm the richest man here, I'm the biggest landowner, I'm going to do this, my wife is going to, we're going to kill a lamb, and we'll have a roasted lamb, and so on and so forth. I also had to supply fine food for the horses, mostly grain, of course. They could graze a little bit, but we had to give them some grain. And after staying there a night or perhaps two, we'd move on. Try to pay, and they would really look at you blankly, absolutely insulted that you should have even thought of paying. You were their guests, and they were honored to look after you and to provide your food and so on. We didn't even have to pay for any food for the horses. The only thing I could do was, whenever the opportunity did arise, and it didn't arise very often, was to stock up with sweets, not a small change, and before leaving, calling as many kids, as there were always plenty of kids round about, calling them to my side there, and dishing out a few coins, pennies and sixpences to various kids, and perhaps a few sweets or chocolates. But of course, as I said, I did not have many sweets to give. The opportunities of buying any sweets were very, very few and far between. None of these villages had any shops or anything at all. Got back, ventured back to Istanbul, Constantinople, up to headquarters, sent in my report, accompanied by a lot of photographs, and the £200 that they had given me to spend, I gave them back about £190. 3 weeks, 3 men, 4 horses, and all we'd spent was about £10. And that was practically all for as little gifts for the various children, etc., that we came across. Well, having done that, I thought it was time to get back to civilian life, and I applied for my DMOB. This I was given, came back to England, and in due course I was repatriated back to Turkey, where I was going to join Francis on his tobacco growing efforts. Now I think I should go back a bit and see what's happened to the other members of the family. First of all, Francis. He was in Smyrna all through the war, in Bujar, of course, free to do what he wanted, except for 3 days when all the Britishers in Smyrna and the suburbs were rounded up and kept under guard because British warships were shelling the outer forts, the Gulf of Smyrna. Now, this of course was quite understandable and there was no ill feeling towards the Turks, but it only lasted 3 days and they were freed again. And Francis lived in the servants' quarters of the house in Bujar. Turks had taken over the whole house, but they let him stay in the servants' quarters. There were a couple of rooms and a wash house kitchen and a downstairs loo. So he was able to stay there. And as far as earning a living was concerned, well, we had the vineyard. And Francis went on working the vineyard with the help of 2 other English lads, quiet lads, young Oliver Ash, Bobby Ash's brother, and Arthur Higginbotham. And they made enough money to keep body and soul together for the rest of the war, with grapes and raisins and so on, selling some, using not themselves, of course. And they survived. After the war, Francis then started tobacco farming. But now I have to go back and talk about Father and the other members of the family. Now, Father carried on with his work at the Metropole Hotel with the Ministry of Munitions till the end of the war. And then the War Office wanted the railway in Smyrna to be got operational, and told Father to get ready to go off at a moment's notice. In the meantime, Alfred, who was killed at the end of the war, had gotten married, and his widow, Connie, joined mother to father, and they went back to Smyrna. Well, the war office was so keen to get father back quickly that they rushed him to Dover, over from Calais, Dover Calais by destroyer, caught the fast express to Marseille, all at the government's expense, and destroyer waiting for them at Marseille went off at full speed all the way from Marseille to Smyrna. That's a couple of days fast traveling. And father restarted the railway. Well, this went on for a bit, and of course the railway still had their, shall I say, unwritten law of a chief engineer, a civil engineer, as general manager. Father was no civil engineer, so they had to find one, and they found a certain General de Candolle, retired, who had been general manager of the Buenos Aires and Great Southern Railway. And they fished him out and brought him out, sent him out to Smyrna as general manager with my father as his assistant. Well, de Candolle was an absolute washout. He made an unholy mess of things, and in 1921, when the fire at Smyrna took place, he bolted. So now I have to digress and come back to what caused the fire of Smyrna, and then I will proceed to describe the happenings inside Smyrna at the time of the fire. See, the fire came about as a result of the peace treaty in 1918-19. I was in Constantinople at the time and saw how the Turks felt about this peace treaty. Whatever one thinks of the harsh terms of the peace treaty against Germany, this was nothing as compared to the harshness of the peace treaty with Turkey. Turkey lost practically everything. And all the islands around Turkey, some of them within practically stone's throw from the Turkish coast, were taken over and given to the Greeks. And then, of course, there was the mainland. On the mainland, Turkey lost all but just a few square miles in Europe. On the Asiatic side, she lost, well, let's start from Africa. She lost Egypt to the British. Then in Asia, she lost Palestine to the League of Nations, or the United Nations. I beg your pardon, to the League of Nations, who put Britain in as administrator. And she also lost Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, all these have been Turkish, Arabia, Mesopotamia, now Iraq, and up in the Caucasus she lost two big provinces to the Russians, Azerbaijan and Armenia. And as if this wasn't enough, when the conference was held in Paris, the Greeks, who had already being given all the islands, demanded Smyrna. Why the Allies ever gave Smyrna to the Greeks, I don't know. No one can really understand it who knows the situation out there. But Smyrna was the lifeblood of the whole country. It was the third or fourth most important port in the Mediterranean, and certainly the most important port in Turkey. All the products of the whole of Asia Minor came to Europe and America via Smyrna. Be it tobacco, figs, raisins, minerals, God knows what, they all came through Smyrna. And this was taken and given to the Greeks. The Turks felt very, very bitter about this indeed. I was in Constantinople with the army of occupation at the time and saw the heart-rending scenes of Turks crying in the street. Every house nearly had a Turkish flag at half-mast draped in black. Every little bumboat in the harbor also had a little flag dressed in black. All the ferry boats, all the steamships, everything you could think of that could fly a flag, flew a flag at half-mast, draped in black. The Greeks arrived in Smyrna under the protection of British warships. They landed, and they behaved atrociously on landing. And I had this from a British naval officer who was concerned with the escorting of the Greeks into Smyrna. And he told me that they saw these Greeks bashing people over the head who were wearing fezes and throwing them into the sea. And on his ship, all hands had to be ordered below deck because the British sailors were uncovering guns and getting ready to shell and fire on the Greeks who were doing this massacring of the Turks. Anyway, the Greeks were not content with occupying Smyrna. They wanted a bit of hinterland. So they took 5 or 6 miles all around Smyrna. And they then started going a bit further and a bit further and a bit further. And this went on and on and on. Now Smyrna had a very large portion of Greek-speaking inhabitants, Christians. Some of them, of course, were Turkish nationals, but they were Christians. But as you went inland, so the population became more and more Turkish. And after about 20, 25 miles, there were no Greeks at all. They were all Turks. But the Greeks still went on advancing, pushing and pushing and pushing. No resistance. And eventually they got about 300 miles in the interior. Just as though the Germans had been given Southampton, and within 18 months they were in Glasgow. Well, Mustafa Kemal, later known as Kemal Atatürk, he raised the flag of revolution against the Sultan. And the people rallied to him. The Sultan was in Constantinople, completely under the, dominion and influence of the Allies. Mustafa Kemal set up his headquarters in Ankara. Hundreds of thousands of Turkish soldiers coming back from the war, most of them had to walk all the way back from Palestine, were coming home, no jobs, in tattered uniforms, most of them had their rifles with them, and of course they all rallied to Mustafa Kemal's army as at least something to do. And of course, one way of perhaps venting their hatred of the Greeks. So Mustafa Kemal went on building this army, and the Greeks went on advancing. Now the Greeks made a dreadful mistake. What the Greek generals were thinking of, I just don't know. For the veriest junior second lieutenant in the British Army could not have ever done what the Greeks did. They advanced 300 miles without bringing in any more armies from Greece. Just the original army of occupation was just stretched and stretched and stretched, just like a piece of elastic. And of course, as it stretched, every so many miles they had to leave a dump of arms and food and so on. And the troops left to advance further got less and less. And by the time they'd gone about 300 miles, as they did, it was quite a weak army. Mustafa Kemal, or Kemal Atatürk, had commanded the Turkish forces in the Dardanelles at the time of our attack there. And he was no mean general. He built up his army